Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dory Smith.
My mission's changed. My battlefield's a different one now, but I still have a mission to care for my soldiers.
Iraq War veteran Chuck Luther shares a Thanksgiving message with President Obama, the U.S. military, and the nation, as he calls for a reevaluation of America's war policy and demands that the U.S. military take care of all soldiers who sustain the invisible wounds of war, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and other forms of war trauma. Chuck Luther was a sergeant in the U.S. military. He was stationed at Fort Hood before shipping out to Iraq. He now says Fort Hood is in crisis and that he has begun a new mission to help fellow soldiers. Chuck Luther is founder of a soldiers advocacy group called Disposable Warriors, disposablewarriors.com. He is also with Military Spouses for Change. Chuck Luther, welcome.
Well, thank you.
First, why the use of the term disposable warriors?
Well, because it's exactly what we are. That's what the nation's warriors are in today's age, is that they put us through tremendous amounts of mental and psychological stresses because of the types of wars that we're waging currently. And when it takes a toll, they didn't prepare to fix us whenever we break, so it's easier to throw us away and make us a disposable warrior versus a fixable warrior, and just put a new young man or woman from a high school off from a nice bonus and throw them out there and just replace them, retrain them, and use them until they break. And that's the cycle that we're in now, disposable warriors.
There is a dramatic story about a Sergeant Boyle on your website, disposablewarriors.com. Boyle was diagnosed with PTSD, but the military command put him out of the military on an administrative discharge for what they called a pattern of misconduct. And Boyle was ordered to repay the Army some $18,000 for a reenlistment bonus. Tell us about what happened to Boyle and why it's part of the big concern you have.
Right. You know, Sergeant Adam Boyle, you know, he was a psychological operations sergeant in a unit out of the 82nd Airborne, and he went and he did two tours of duty over there. He witnessed some pretty horrific things, and they even acknowledged that, hey, you do have PTSD, you do have psychological injuries, we're going to get you help, and they didn't. That's just to pacify him in between his deployments, and then when he finally broke, when he got back from his second deployment, that's what they did. They turned around and said, you know what, we're going to kick you out of the Army for a pattern of misconduct. He got a Chapter 14-12, which is the pattern of misconduct discharge the Army uses currently, and they allowed him to self-medicate with alcohol and things of that nature. He had violent outbreaks, things like that. He got in a fight at a bar. So they said, hey, you know what, you're not a good soldier anymore. You're not what we're looking for in leadership, and we're gonna kick you out. So they started the chapter, and they said, oh, yeah, and by the way, administratively separating you, you owe us your unearned portion of your bonuses. Now, what they do to young people to get them in the Army or to keep them in the Army, they entice them with $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, even up to $40,000 and $50,000 lump sum bonuses to reenlist for 4, 6, 8 more years to keep their numbers where they need. And then when they break them, they say, hey, guess what? It's because of your fault, because you're a bad soldier now, and you owe us what you should have been able to stay in the Army and earned, but because you're not going to be around, because you're getting kicked out, because you're not a good soldier anymore, you have to pay us that back. And that happens more times than we would rather think about every day here in the United States.
You've mentioned to journalists like Dar Jamail that you think the numbers of soldiers traumatized by PTSD and even attempting suicide could be much higher than what are being reported. Can you just explain what you mean?
Absolutely. Just this week, I've had conversations with 5 soldiers here from Fort Hood, and all of them, every one of them, off-post providers, have diagnosed severe PTSD symptoms. They haven't made the diagnosis because they don't want to overstep their boundaries with active duty soldiers, but they've all said, and I've talked to several of these counselors, and they said, yeah, these guys are really messed up. They've multiple deployments, 22, 23 years old on their third tour of war, and they won't come forward. And I said, well, let's get you some help. And the exact words out of these soldiers' mouths were, well, I'm 24 and I'm a sergeant and I have a family to feed. I can't afford to because they're going to kick me out of the Army. These are the things that soldiers know. And then as for the suicides, we just had an incident on Thursday morning, I was aware of that a soldier attempted suicide here at Fort Hood. And when I dug a little deeper and found out, this soldier had attempted suicide one other time, and the chain of command had not reported that to the higher-ups, and they didn't do anything about it. And here we are again with a young man in ICU at 19, 20 years old. And, you know, the Army uses the term under investigation to hide a lot of things. We have soldiers here at Fort Hood, 11, 12, 13 deaths this year. And, you know, if you check on the numbers, they'll report that they only had two suicides as of 2009 that were confirmed. The other ones are under investigation. And you have one of the cases is a young man out of California that was very suicidal, was supposed to be guarded at all times, escorted all of his appointments, and he was not. The chain of command said they were tired of babysitting him. They let him go. He got bad news from his lawyer. He came back, went to his room. He slit his wrist, and he took an overdose of drugs and died. And that case is still under investigation. And when I asked some people at Fort Hood, how is that under investigation? They said, well, we need to rule out homicide. Well, I don't know. I'm not a criminal forensic specialist, but I do know that I don't think people would break into somebody's dorm room in the barracks on post and slit somebody's wrist and force them to ingest large amounts of psychopathic drugs to kill them. So it's a bad scene that I think that if the Army were to let us know exactly how many soldiers are being affected psychologically and how many are committing suicide truly, I think that the American public would be truly astonished, because they're already wavering, I believe, on their support for these occupations that we're currently enrolled in. I don't think the Army wants to lose any more support at this time.
Now, you're Chuck Luther to a lot of people reading the website, but you're also Sergeant Chuck Luther, and I think that means something to soldiers that share some of the history you do. Why don't you talk about the significance of your own experience in the military, Chuck, and explain your choice to set up this group of soldiers advocating for soldiers?
I'm honored. Every case that I take, every soldier's phone call I get, or every spouse of a soldier or a parent, when they call me and they ask me simple questions, and they read the website or they read my story somewhere, and they just pour out and they identify. They're like, wow, we're not the only ones. Because I'll tell you, when I was going through what I went through in an aid station in Taji, Iraq, I believed at that moment, when I got very suicidal and I just wanted to give up, that I was the only person in the world and that maybe there was something wrong with me. I started to believe maybe I do have this personality disorder, they're calling it. Maybe something has been wrong with me. For 36 years, maybe I just skated through and was never found out. After 12 years in the Army, maybe I masked it. Maybe I didn't even know I was doing it. And I was spiraling down. And when I got home and I realized the reality that my military career, the thing that I served with so much honor and the one thing that defined me as an individual, I finally found the one thing in life that I excelled at, and I loved doing what I was doing, because I was serving my nation. I was standing in a position of honor. I was helping people that couldn't help themselves, and then it all fell apart, and I had contemplated committing suicide. Unfortunately, I got to that point the day they took my rank off my uniform and told me to exit the post and go let the VA deal with me. The exact words were, I said, I have an appointment. I'm actually feeling a little better with this psychiatrist here on post, but I have an appointment tomorrow, and you're putting me out of the Army today. And the first sergeant said, you're no longer an active duty member. You're the VA's problem. And so as they escorted me off the post, I got really depressed, and I had every intention of coming back on post with a firearm and committing suicide in front of the post command there at 3 Corps to make a statement that, you know what, this is wrong. You're destroying lives. I have a wife and 3 kids. What am I going to do now? Well, something happened in between there, and it all came together, and the words disposable warriors came about. And I was talking to my wife one night, and it was there, and she said, what are you talking about? And I said, that's what we are. And she said, what do you mean? And I explained to her where I was going with this. And then, you know, I've been asked, why did I choose to do what I do? And I, you know what, to be honest with you, I didn't choose this. It chose me. I've had commanders ask me, where did you come from? What's your official background to be an advocate? And I said, you know, you guys created me. You tried to destroy me, And here I am, after all the dust and the rubble settles, just like in Iraq, IED after IED in a Humvee, or the mortar blast that knocked me over. When it was all said and done, they trained me to be a fighter, and here I am standing, ready to fight, ready to move forward again. And the soldiers call, and they identify, because, you know, I'm not a guy from college that's a bad thing, but I'm not a guy from college or somebody that's never served that just wants to do the right thing. I have a lot of credibility because I've been there. I've done that. I've wore the boots. I've taken the bullets. I've fought the chains of command, and I've seen that there is more, that you don't have to accept you're a bad soldier, have a nice life, we've used you up, we have no need for you now. And it spurned other soldiers, other veterans, to jump in and help out and to start their own organizations and fight for legislation to be passed to try to stop this at a higher level instead of case at a time. I'm the field guy. I'm the guy that's going to take it case by case, personal by personal. It doesn't matter to me. Every case is important. And I'm going to fight just as hard for the next as I did the last. But there are some people that I admire that they want to go to legislation and pass it there to stop it from the higher-ups down, to keep it from happening so much.
Chuck, I'm sure your webpage, disposablewarriors.com, is helping a lot of people. And there are soldiers and their families, including yours, that have a lot to be thankful for this Thanksgiving. But tell us what happened while you were in Iraq that caused you to have such an intense struggle within yourself.
You know, I think over there in Iraq, of course, I was a 19 Delta Recon Scout, and I knew going in that, you know, we had a very tough job. You know, everybody knows you could Google the most dangerous job in the military, and there 19 Delta pops up. We were the guys that we'd go out in squad elements of 6, 8, or 12 guys into a village of 4 and 5 and 1,000 people, and not knowing what we were going to encounter. And we'd end up in firefights with 70, 80 guys versus 6 of us. And it was a very dangerous thing. And I knew that. And I had no problem with that. And if it meant giving the ultimate sacrifice for my country, which at the time I believed was a good reason to be in Iraq, then so be it. But as you get there and as you find out the truth, what the people here in America hear and exactly what happens in Iraq, in Afghanistan, are two different worlds. You know, we just currently see about the canal shootings. We're starting to hear more and more about some sergeants and higher leaders there making decisions to execute people just because they didn't want to have to deal with them again. And when you get into a situation in a firefight and you're told that there are bad guys in a house, and you go at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, you end up in a firefight because somebody fires a round and everybody starts firing once a round's fired because you're tired. You're exhausted, 4 hours of sleep every 2 or 3 days, no food at times, living in an outpost where you don't get running water or showers except every 30 days you go in and you get a shower and stuff and a chance to sleep on a real bed, and all the stresses of it. And when all this stuff's said and done and you find out that your unit, your squad, had just killed 3 or 4 women and a bunch of children and no bad guys are to be found. You know, after a while, that takes a toll on you. And then whenever you see your best friends and your fellow soldiers blown up and put in body bags, it just wears on you. I don't care how tough of a man. I thought there for a while, you know, I can't say nothing. I'm a sergeant. I'm leader of these guys. I'm a father. I'm a man. I can't do this. You know, the society tells us you can't be weak. But it wasn't about being weak, I found out. It was about, you know, just being overwhelmed with loss of life and inhumanity. And, you know, over there when I asked for help, I didn't want to ask for help because everybody knew that you really don't ask for help because you can lose your security clearance, which we had. So I didn't say nothing. But then when it finally got to the point where it was overwhelming, and it was obvious that I couldn't go on any further, and one of my buddies told me, hey, you need to ask for help. And I did, they turned their backs on me. The leaders said that I was faking my symptoms, that I was malingering using the medical system, that I was lying about being blown up, all the way as to the fact that I've had some senior leaders at first say that I wasn't even in Iraq. And the crazy thing is I was awarded a combat action badge for engaging and fighting the enemy in Iraq. So I don't know how, if I weren't there, why I was awarded a thing and why I have pictures on the streets of Iraq of myself and my fellow soldiers. But the trauma of war actually wasn't what did it that most to me. It was that I found out that the very people that I went there with as my comrades and as my people, they turned on me. I mean, when they housed me in an aid station for 5 weeks and talked to me worse than a criminal and refused to take me to eat chow because I had been asleep because they were giving me medicine to make me sleep from the nightmares and stuff, and they wouldn't wake me up, and they would give me MREs, and they would laugh at me, and I had my soldiers that were lower ranking than me talking back to me in the command doing nothing, and they were just really bad. That's where it really started affecting me, because I got scared for my own safety now. I'm 8,000 miles away, and the people that are supposed to protect me and take care of me are turning on me. So devastating-wise, it destroyed me, and it started affecting my marriage and my kids' relationships and everybody around me. And I came home, and the whole disposable orders thing is that the whole idea was, if we can keep one family, one soldier from going through this, then that is what we'll do. And we did that a long time ago, and now we're well over 130 cases currently working and about 70 resolved. And we've went from not just the Army. I've had to deal with two cases in the Air Force and one in the Marine Corps of abuse and neglect of soldiers. And here we are. You know, it's therapy to me. I still have the nightmares. I still take all the pills that the VA has to give me to keep my anxiety down, to keep my temper down, to keep my nightmares away and all that. But this is my therapy. This is where I want to be, and this is what I want to do, and this is what I'll continue to do. The command here at Fort Hood, at first, when Disposable Warriors stood up shortly after I was exited from service, the last post commander basically would say that I was a troublemaker, say that I was just, you know, mad because I got put in the Army because I couldn't cut it, things like that. And I let them rile me for a while, and then after a while I just started using factual information to combat him back and not get into a personal attack with him, but just to tell him, look, you talk about me all you want, but take care of soldiers. The question was asked to me, how long are you going to do this? I said, as long as I have a breath in my body. And then they said, well, what makes you do this? I mean, why do you do this? Do you know this soldier? Do you know that soldier? I said, no, I don't know him personally until now, but it's the right thing to do. And being an NCO, a non-commissioned officer in the United States Army, you have the NCO creed. And there's two key parts of that that I've always held dear to me, and they've always implied it whenever you're learning it, when you're coming up, and it's the accomplishment of your mission and the welfare of your soldiers. Those are the two key points. And my mission's changed. My battlefield's a different one now. But I still have a mission to care for my soldiers. And the charge of the NCO creed that is the welfare of your soldiers is the greatest thing at any time. So this is where we're at. And for whatever reason, this is how I've gotten brought to this stage of my life. And then this is where we'll stay.
Chuck Luther, just explain what it means, the Chapter 513 personality disorder discharge. I mean, what did that mean to you? And have you sorted out some of the reasons that you were under the kind of pressure that you were when you were still at the war zone? I mean, why did they do this? And why did they want to give you the personality disorder diagnosis, if you will, as opposed to a PTSD diagnosis?
After reviewing and looking at it, the personality disorder is a pre-existing condition. And the way the Army does it, almost every personality disorder that I've seen come out of the Army, they qualify it as an NOS, not otherwise specified. And I've talked to several leading mental health professionals around the country and a couple out of the country. And they just grimace every time they see the word NOS, because there are 12 or 13 types of personality disorder characteristics that you can qualify somebody under, one or the other, or a couple at a time. But for them to say NOS, basically they're admitting that, hey, we don't know. No one can have every trait of all types of personality disorders. It doesn't happen. You have to be qualified. Well, I was screened in about 2 15-minute conversations while I was in Iraq by a licensed clinical social worker, which makes mental health professionals grimace too, because he was not a psychiatrist. He was not a psychologist. And to rule out PTSD, especially in a combat zone, it would take months. You have to corroborate and interview the soldier's family. You have to interview their friends. You have to interview their past employers, their neighbors. You need to find out, did something change along the lines? And something that I did find out, A leading traumatic brain injury doctor from Dallas came down to the VA here in Temple, Texas, and said, "Hey, so you've got PTSD and you got separated from the Army?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, how'd you get put out?" And I said, "A Chapter 513. And he immediately put his head down, and he shook his head. He said, "Don't let this happen to you." And I was like, "What?" And he said, "Well, you suffered a traumatic brain injury." He diagnosed it that day, and he said, "After a traumatic brain injury and PTSD, you cannot diagnose a personality disorder because the personality traits change from the balance and the makeup of your brain after those two, PTSD and TBI. So you can't say that." And that's why they have to go back into your past and see, how were you before? I wasn't an angry person. I had no levels of anxiety. I was the guy everybody came to my house to hang out on the weekends. Even my soldiers and families, we'd grill in the backyard and have fun for 30 hours at a time, and I'd be the guy telling jokes. Well, now I'm getting back kind of to the old self, but after that, I'm the guy that nobody wants to come around because they didn't know if you were going to explode or not. The reasoning why the Army does the 513 is because it's an administrative separation and not a medical. Therefore, it is the quickest, most expedient way to put somebody out of the Army. As you can see, they put me out in about 12 days, once they got me out of the war zone and were able to do paperwork. Well, they got me out in 12 days from the day I got back here to the day they kicked me out. Where with a medical, it takes months, if not a year or plus, to do that. And then the diagnosis of PTSD is a 50% disabling factor. Well, in the Army, if you have a 30% or higher service-connected disability, you are medically retired from the military. So that equivalates out to a lot of money, where when I was put out with the 513, I had to pay back nearly $14,000 in bonuses and unearned portions of pay. They kept all my pay for almost 3 months. And the day I was exited from service, I received a bill in the mail for $1,501 from the Department of Finance for equipment that I couldn't account for that was lost in battle. So they recouped money there. You know, they gave it to me, but they took it back, and then they kept my paycheck. So the Army actually made money. I was free labor, pretty much. In any other job, if you do that to an employee, then you're going to have a big lawsuit. If an employee even does something like steal something, assault somebody on the job, you cannot hold their paychecks of the money they earned to that point. But this is the Army, so the retirement part of it was gonna mean a lot of stuff. That means they were going to either have to give me a lump sum payment based upon their factors that they use, or they were going to have to give me a lifetime benefit for the rest of my life, a monthly payment for my disability. I'm currently at 70% from the VA's rating system now with the PTSD, TBI, and some other physical injuries. And it's actually being reviewed because they believe that I should be higher because I have migraines from traumatic brain injury about every 10 days where I'm out for like 2 days of work and I can't do anything because I have to stay in the house and relax and recover. So what it meant to me more than any of all that, more than the money, more than the time frames, I would have gladly accepted a general discharge and allowed me to go on about my way because I have a DD-214 currently, and the one I got when I was sent out of service in 07. And every time I look at it, I get angry because it says Chapter 513, reason for whatever is personality disorder. And it's a stigma. And I know there's nothing mentally wrong with me. I do not have a disease, they call it, that I was born with. You know, and it's frustrating. It cost me jobs. When I got kicked out of the Army, I really had nowhere to go. I didn't have a lot of formal training that could equivalent out going into a recession. The only jobs I could find were private security firms and like Blackwater. I could have gotten hired with them, but whenever I sent them my DD-214, they said, "Ooh, yeah, we can't take you if you got put out with that because that means that you have a mental disorder." And I said, "I don't." And she said, "We believe you don't, but until that gets fixed, we can't take you." Well, that was a $150,000 a year job that cost me. And then the humiliation of being told, you know, you served your country well in Iraq, but now we can't use you. And so it's frustrating, and that's why my case is currently under review by the Department of the Army and some other Senate people on how they did me and how it came out. And hopefully, we're hoping very soon that we can get an overturn and get it turned into a medical discharge, retirement from the Army.
You're not a pacifist. You didn't reject the war per se, but you felt that you had become disposable after sustaining injuries in the war zone. But if you got the chance to sit down at, let's say, a huge round table with President Obama and maybe a few of the Joint Chiefs, some soldiers and their families, what would your Thanksgiving message be?
I've got a larger stance since I've been back from Iraq. Before I went to Iraq, I was never any anti-war at all. But I'm anti-unnecessary war to a point. I mean, when there's no tangible good coming out of what we're doing, you have to look at it from a business perspective, I believe, also, because I know that our president and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all those people involved with military matters, it's a business. Government is a business. Military and war is a business, and you have to look at it from such, and you have to look at it that is the cost worth the benefit? And we have to look at it and say, no, it's not my opinion. It's factual opinion. With over 5,000 dead and counting in between these two occupations, and we haven't done anything in either one. I've seen in Iraq how we took a nation that had an infrastructure and a leadership, whether we agreed or not agreed with it. They sure weren't a democratic nation like we say we are, but they had their things going, and we went in and we destroyed it all, and it's still in chaos. As of 07, when I was physically there, it's horrid. I mean, I don't see how those people are going to be able to come back from it without us funneling more and more billions of dollars in to fix what we broke for no reason. And then the same thing in Afghanistan. We're fighting a Taliban, and we're destroying parts of their country, and we're there. But all that aside, let's forget Chuck Luther's personal opinion of the war. Let's talk to the leaders, like you said. My thing is this. Whether or not I or 50,000 other people get together and hold a protest and say we don't believe in the war, it doesn't matter. The wars are going to go on. Unfortunately, wars are a part of necessity. I believe that there were parts of war. My grandfather fought in World War II. I believe that that was a war of necessity. That called for us to be the people we claim to be and to liberate and preserve people's lives that were otherwise being overrun. But forget the whole anti-war sentiment. It's irrelevant, really. We're at war. We got it. Soldiers are going to enlist. Somebody asked me, do you want to go protest the recruiting station? I said, absolutely not, because I believe we have to have a military, because I think the world's getting worse and worse as we go, and without a military power, you're going to be in trouble if you can't defend yourself. But in the young guys and the young women that go in there, you know what? A lot of those young people are looking for a life, because without the military, they're not going to have any. Me, as a teenager, I didn't know what I was going to do. When I joined the military at 18 years old the first time, when I first went in 1988, that was the best thing in the world for me. My discipline, everything about me changed. I wasn't a bad kid, but I certainly wasn't the greatest, and it changed me. It molded me, and it made me who I am today with my principles and my morals and my family structure. Well, let's get down to the bottom line. When every one of them, regardless of being the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Marines, you raise your hand, you take the oath, you're entering into a contract saying that I will give my allegiance to this country, I will die for this country and follow everything my commander and the chief says. But there's a flip side to that. It's a two-part contract. Not only will we give our lives, but if we do give our lives in battle, in the ultimate sacrifice, if we have family, you're going to give them, you know, our benefit. You're going to take care of them on behalf of us because we fought hard and honorably. And if we get injured, then you're going to take care of us. You're going to fix us and get us back out into the battle. And if we can't go back out in the battle, then you're going to fix us as close as you can to how you found us before we came in the military and allow us to go back to society and live a peaceful life and go on about our lives.
We'll hear more from Chuck Luther in part two of this Thanksgiving week special. The website is disposablewarriors.com. The group works out of the Fort Hood area as soldiers' advocates. We'll put up some lists of soldiers' support networks as well as peace groups on our website, and we hope you'll visit us for Thanksgiving at talknationradio.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. TalkNationRadio@gmail.com if you'd like to comment on this broadcast.
How many flags do we have to hand to parents and spouses and try to explain why they died?
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio and the second part of our interview with Chuck Luther, founder of the soldiers' support group, Disposable Warriors, disposablewarriors.com. The name is derived from Chuck Luther's personal experience in Iraq, where he says he felt like a disposable warrior. Chuck Luther was serving in Taji, Iraq during 2006 and 2007 under major combat conditions when he sustained invisible wounds of war, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and a likely TBI, traumatic brain injury. After many sleepless nights, nightmares, headaches, bouts of anger, and other symptoms, Luther asked for help. He was then sent to an aid station, where for 5 weeks he endured ridicule and low rations. A social worker misdiagnosed him as a Chapter 513 personality disorder. The hasty medical decision by a non-doctor gave the military the language they needed to drum Chuck Luther out without having to give him benefits.
They put us through a tremendous amount of mental and psychological stresses because of the types of wars that we're waging currently. And when it takes a toll, they didn't prepare to fix us whenever we break, so it's easier to throw us away and make us a disposable warrior versus a fixable warrior and just put a new young man or woman from a high school, offer them a nice bonus and throw them out there and just replace them, retrain them, and use them until they break. And that's the cycle that we're in now, disposable warriors.
In part one of our interview, Chuck Luther explained that he was under serious pressure after being mistreated in Iraq, and he had thoughts of suicide. Luckily, he envisioned a new mission for himself instead. He would help himself and then work to help other soldiers avoid suicide by founding a SAG, Soldiers Advocacy Group. Chuck Luther had been based at Fort Hood in Texas for the military before heading out to Iraq. Now he runs the group Disposable Warriors in the Fort Hood area. He advocates for others who may have been misdiagnosed and have mental, behavioral, or physical health issues to sort out. Often under these conditions, the military will withhold pay or demand reenlistment bonuses back, as in the case of a soldier named Boyle who was asked to return $18,500. Normally, Chuck Luther told us, soldiers will fulfill their part of their contract with the military. He now is demanding that the military fulfill theirs.
I have yet to see soldiers, airmen, marine, or seamen not fulfill their obligation once they get to battle, because you're there. You have to. It doesn't matter if you're anti-war or not. You are there. And when you have a man shoot an RPG at you and watching your buddies die around you, you will fight. I don't care how much anti you are. You will want to live to get home to fight against what is going wrong. Well, there's a lot of things going on. In my case, Sergeant Boyle's case, I can name tons of them off. You can pull the internet up and see. They're not doing their part of the bargain. The military is not. They're not honoring their part of the contract, and they're not taking care of us. They are throwing us away. Unless we have some radical changes in our mental health system, in our medical system, in the whole integrity of the military as a whole, unfortunately, the five Novembers at Fort Hood, Texas, are not going to stop. That was one of the greatest tragedies, I think, that I've seen in my time as 39 years on this earth that could have been avoided several times over. But because it would have gotten in the way of progress, I think we turned a blind eye, and now we have 13 lives lost, 30 changed, one life ruined, and thousands here at Fort Hood. I don't even like going on post myself now with PTSD, getting around a bunch of soldiers. You just don't know if a soldier has been ridiculed, harassed, or beat up. Is he at that snapping point? And obviously, we've seen that soldiers can get firearms on military bases that they feel have betrayed them. So unless we do something radical, unless we start reaching out and touching, it's just a downward spiral. And I demand of the president and everybody that has an influential decision-making use of what's going on in our military with our young men and women to stand up and say, fine, we're going to fight a war, but we're going to do it the right way. That's a demand that has to be met. It's not negotiable. It's not if we think about it. It has to happen. And that's why people like myself, Paul Sullivan, the Given Hour Foundation, IVAW, that's where we all come from. Is because we all have different views, but we have the same goals of enough is enough.
In a Thanksgiving message, President Obama said it was time to remember those who cannot sit down to break bread with those they love. He was talking about casualties from the Iraq and Afghan wars. We're focusing on soldiers from these wars who feel so overwhelmed by them that they have sustained invisible wounds and commit suicide. It is an act of irrational desire for change, an attempt to eradicate pain, and most often it's attempted under conditions of extreme stress when people are not themselves and they behave irrationally and compulsively. The conditions of these two occupations have produced astounding numbers of casualties from suicide. In January of 2009, even as President Barack Obama was taking the oath of office, the Army had finally released some of the shocking news of suicides in U.S. soldiers that month. According to the Army, 24 soldiers had killed themselves in January alone. It was a number 6 times higher than the statistic in 2008. It was also higher than the number of soldiers killed in combat. According to a CNN story, a U.S. Army official said, quote, "This is terrifying. We do not know what's going on." But is that really true? Certainly the military has had many cases of suicide to study at this point. Hundreds of U.S. soldiers have killed themselves, and others have done so without having their deaths counted as a suicide. They are, quote, "pending investigation," said Chuck Luther. In his Thanksgiving message, President Obama also went on to say, "We should remember the soldier who is, quote, overseas, holding down a lonely post and missing his kids, the sailor who left her home to serve a higher calling, the folks who must spend Thanksgiving apart from their families to work a second job so they can keep food on the table or send a child to school." It was a touching message. The president said he was grateful beyond words for the service and hard work of U.S. soldiers. And he said, quote, "This year, we know that far too many face a daily struggle that puts the comfort and security we all deserve painfully out of reach." For the families of soldiers who've killed themselves, the president has not seen their pain clearly enough. He has refused to sign a White House condolence letter to them, as he does in cases of soldiers killed in combat. The families complained in a New York Times story, November 25th, by James Dow. This is the voice of Sergeant Jacob Blalick. Erica Good provided a video to the New York Times, which appeared alongside of Dow's story.
Hey, it's Jackie. It's the 20th of April. We go home in 6 days. I lost 2 good friends on the 14th. I'm having a hard time dealing with it.
And she offered a portrait of a young soldier named Sergeant Blalock, who was so haunted by the memory of his fellow comrades that he took his own life. But Sergeant Blalock was also a victim of repeated IED blasts, the kind that often lead to traumatic brain injury and erratic behavior. In a Pacifica special for Sprouts, a grieving father, Charles McKinney, told us he wanted better aftercare for any soldier who sustained a blast injury and may have sustained brain injury.
You know, he had his dreams, and he didn't get to fulfill his dreams because of the effects, we feel like, primarily of traumatic brain injury. He had suffered several IEDs his first tour. He was in Bradley fighting vehicles, and his Bradley got hit several times, and he was fortunate, and no one was wounded bad, no one died, and he used to laugh and call himself the EOD, which is Explosive Ordnance Disposal, because he could find them and blow them up and not kill anybody in his unit, in his vehicle.
Sergeant Jeff McKinney sustained repeated traumatic brain injuries from IED explosions and showed profound symptoms afterward.
But we think the percussions of those blasts, the blast caused traumatic brain injury to him, and I think he sat there for a year while he was home, and then he had to go back again. There was like several days before he died. He was in a Humvee, and they hit a huge IED. It blew up 2 feet in front of them and just rocked their vehicle. And the men with him in the vehicle said that had it hit the vehicle, it would have all been dead. And the medics seemed to think that triggered the really effective Jeff there, that brain injury there, plus the horrendous losses that the unit was taking. His battalion lost 31 men on that tour there, most since Vietnam for one battalion. And Jeff was pulling dead bodies and seeing things, you know, that just, I think he felt like he was the father, and he had to take care of these young men, and he couldn't, and he couldn't do anything about it, and it was just, he didn't know how to recognize the symptoms of what he was going through, and he didn't know what to do about it.
With psychotropic drugs in his system, he had been sleep-deprived and traumatized. He had been having blackouts. He had been showing signs of depression. And one final IED blast hit him before he finally put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger in front of soldiers in his command. Jeff McKinney had been having some of the same symptoms Chuck Luther described on his website, DisposableWarriors.com. They're symptoms of stress. They're the symptoms of PTSD. And Chuck Luther said he contemplated doing the very same thing that Jeff McKinney did, but he managed to survive. The McKinney family, Chuck Luther, and others are now calling on the White House and the military to implement emergency-level changes in the way soldiers are treated. As some 30 to 40,000 more U.S. soldiers deploy to Afghanistan, the policy of how soldiers with symptoms of PTSD are treated must be implemented immediately, they say, lest more soldiers die from these invisible wounds. The warning signs of traumatic brain injury or PTSD and other stress reactions should be something every soldier knows and every soldier is trained to respond to save his fellow soldier. Instead of this kind of policy, the U.S. military has a well-established practice of denying claims of PTSD automatically. Some say it's to avoid the high cost of treatment for these soldiers. And it's clear that this has been discussed as policy, not as an accident or coincidence in these cases. In 2008, Dr. Norma Perez, a mental health integration specialist at the VA's Medical Center in Temple, Texas, wrote an email that is now infamous. She said, quote, "Given that we're having more and more compensation-seeking veterans, I'd like to suggest that you refrain from giving a diagnosis of PTSD straight out. Consider a diagnosis of adjustment disorder," she said. In his report on Chuck Luther's Disposable Warriors Project at Fort Hood, journalist Dar Jamail pointed out that the November 5th shootings there were something Luther feared. He wrote that 2 months before the shootings, Luther had warned the Army's chain of command that dramatic changes were needed, or else a soldier might kill other soldiers. It was something that had already happened in May in Baghdad, when a soldier named Russell killed 5 people at a stress clinic he was attending there. We asked Chuck Luther if he thought the military turned a blind eye to the problems of Major Hassan and at the base in general because they just wanted to keep things moving forward with the war and deployment of troops in general.
I think so. You know, it's really a touchy situation, I know, with a lot of people. You know, if they were to have gone back a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, whatever it is that they're even reporting in the media and in the news, that Major Hassan had did a PowerPoint. He spoke out. His peers had told the supervisors and the higher-ups, hey, listen, something's wrong here. This guy's not right. You know, I believe that if they would have stood up and said, wow, could you imagine with us fighting a war in two countries that are predominantly Muslim and Islamic, that we would have come out in the media a year and a half ago and said, we've exited a major, a psychiatric mental health professional from the military because he's Muslim and has strong Muslim beliefs and does not believe in the wars in Iraq. Now, devastating that would have been for our fight to continue on. Do you know how many people in the world would have gotten really angry to hear that? That even our own soldiers, our own officers, our leaders, are not agreeing with what's going on. And unfortunately, the shooter the day of 5 November allegedly was Major Hassan, and unfortunately, he was Muslim. If he would have been an African-American soldier, if he were a Jewish soldier, I don't think we would be here. It's just unfortunate that he was Muslim. And I think that the Army doesn't react until it has to. That's the one thing I've learned about it. It will not react unless it has to. Like over in Iraq, prime example in my case, they had told me that I was going to stay in the aid station for the last 6 months of our 15-month tour, and then when I got home, they were going to deal with me. Only after that, whenever I spiraled downward even more so and got very suicidal, did they realize they needed to get me out of there, because could you imagine the answers that they would have had to come to, because my wife and my senators here knew about some of what was going on, not the whole truth. If they would have got a phone call that I had committed suicide over there when it was already known, it's the whole plausible deniability thing. You know, if you don't know about it, then you're not accountable for it. But once you're aware of the situation. You're fully accountable, and Lord knows you don't want to fall in that category of looking and going, wow, well, we knew, but why didn't we do something? Hence, the army at this juncture with Hassan. So I believe they allow some things to go on further, and now we paint it out not that he was extremely upset about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that he didn't think they were right wars, and that after counseling soldier after soldier after soldier and hearing the horrific things coming out of those countries, I don't think the army wanted him to be able to talk anymore. So if he does explode and flip out, or if he just goes AWOL, well, then he's just an extremist Muslim that was a jihadist, and I don't buy into all that. I don't buy that he was all those things, because I know a little bit more about Islamic extremist jihadists, because we lived on the streets and in the villages with them in Iraq for 9 months, and everything that I know about Muslims that want to martyr themselves and fight against America and the great Satan, they call us, and stuff like that, are carried out in totally different ways. They're not just out of the blue, I'm going to get coffee at 6:30 in the morning at 7-Eleven and eat hash browns, and then, you know, 7.5 hours later, I'm going to commit 13 counts of murder. It just doesn't add up. So I believe that all the way back to September 11th, we had credible intelligence that there was going to be an attack. We didn't know the exact specifics of the time, the place, and the origin, but we knew it was going to happen. And instead of stepping in and stepping up our security, we stood down. And then we stood by, and we watched a horrific action happen, and then we scurried to say what's happened. Then we used the American emotion of what's happened to turn it around and then blame somebody for it. And it's just a follow-through again. Here we are again. And unfortunately, it happened with an Army officer on an Army base.
You're listening to a Talk Nation radio special, taped during the week of Thanksgiving 2009. Just prior to the start of the holiday season, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke from Afghanistan about America's mission there. Her words held clues as to the likely time frame for benchmarks the White House is expected to announce about America's role. Reading between the lines of what she said, it seems America's role is likely to go on for at least 5 years. That just to achieve sufficient security to control Afghanistan.
And I was very pleased to hear today when President Karzai said that he hopes that within 3 years the Afghan security forces will have the lead in important areas, and within 5 years, which is an ambitious goal, but he stated it, the Afghan security forces would have the lead throughout the country.
The Obama administration appears to be soft-pedaling the number of years America will occupy Afghanistan, and they're under pressure from left, right, and center on the unpopular Afghan and Iraq wars. But the military escalation and further deployment has been going on behind the scenes of rhetoric about Obama taking time to make a decision.
And my only point is, it's not too late.
An ABC News Green Room segment the network put online sheds light on the dilemma.
You know, we still have a chance. General McChrystal has laid out a counterinsurgency strategy that would allow us to go in and secure key areas in order to provide the kind of security those villagers need to know they can fight off the Taliban.
Former State Department official Elizabeth Cheney, a leading Republican neoconservative on Mideast policy, is in discussion with former Treasury Secretary Robert Reich and journalist Walter Isaacson. Even the conservative George Will was more skeptical about the wisdom of the current Afghan policy than Liz Cheney, who was, after all, sent to the Mideast by her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney and President Bush, to do public relations work. She commented on the impression people might have of the U.S. operation in Afghanistan.
Actually, what happens in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan, where we've gone in, we've taken down the government, we've got a new government in place, if we are not providing security, the people say, well, wait a minute, America is very powerful. Mm-hmm. You're occupying us and you're not providing security.
You have 5 countries in that region, all of whom really do not want a radical Sunni Taliban regime there. You have India, you have China, you even have Iran, you certainly have Russia, and you certainly have Pakistan. So I do not think it should be our sole responsibility to occupy and hold large swatches of territory there. We should encourage a whole lot of people to say the Taliban's not in your interest.
Chuck Luther, I wanted to ask you what you thought about this ABC segment, because It seemed as if Elizabeth Cheney was articulating a need for America to provide security for Afghanistan, and in a way there was a public relations angle there, you know, that we're worried about the way we're perceived in the region, and then the conversation about whether or not we can do it. But for soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan and in Iraq, it's a matter of life and death. And I think the question people want to know the answer to is it worth it?
Exactly. And, you know, I blame our administration, past and present, because, you know, initially after the September 11th attacks, and we ruled that Osama bin Laden had done it, and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and all these things, they had pretty credible evidence that that's where it was going. And, you know, I was all for, let's go to Afghanistan where these guys are and let's remove them. Let's arrest them if we can't arrest them. If they're killed in battle, then, you know, let's deal with it. But at the time, I didn't understand fully the whole terrorist network thing. That, first of all, the day George W. Bush stood up and proclaimed a war on terrorism, I will give him some credit. He did legitimately say some truthful things. He did say it's going to be a long and costly war. Only did we know how long and how costly it would cost us and how long it would be. He claimed something that I believe from a tactical combat soldier perspective, that is, you cannot reach it. It's unattainable. You cannot win against terrorism, simply because it can be anywhere at any time. There are different acts of terrorism. So we went to there to Afghanistan, and we devoted, you know, that whole first month into just beating up on everything and everybody we could in Afghanistan, and we ran the Taliban out of control of their government. And then it seemed like we just let it go. And then February of the following year, we decide that we're going to do the shock and awe, and we're going after Saddam Hussein because of weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, there was never a complete link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, okay? I walked the streets of a lot of cities in Iraq over a nine-month span, and I promise you that I never saw one weapon of mass destruction. I never saw any nuclear, biological, chemical warfare that could harm the United States. I never saw any of that. But we kind of started the war on the right end, I think, you know, the whole war on terrorism, going after the people responsible for September 11th. That was the whole reason for these two occupations that we're currently in. That was the knee-jerk reaction. Other than that, if September 11th wouldn't happen, we would not be in both of those countries right now. So here we are in Afghanistan, and then we focus from 25,000 to 30,000 troops over there. We turn around and we pour in 160,000, 180,000 soldiers into this country of Iraq, and we stay there. And we leave alone what's going on in Afghanistan. And, you know, I'd made the comment, hey, I'd just soon go to Afghanistan because there's less stuff going on over there. I don't want to be here. This is crazy, you know, not knowing what day you're going to get blown up, multiple times even. And so all we did was we created our own failure, because they used us as a training ground over in Iraq. They watched our every move, the enemy being terrorists, and they watched our every move. They watched how we react in a four-vehicle convoy. If they blow up the lead vehicle, how the next three vehicles are going to recover. They watched all of our tactical training. They watched how we're going to react to sniper attacks. They watched how we're going to combat multiple IED attacks, how we're going to attack and combat the RPG attacks and things like that, how we're going to train ourselves to be in that kind of a climate. They did all that, and they built back up over in Afghanistan. And you see exactly what I'm talking about is happening, because we are losing more soldiers at a greater rate per capita over there right now in Afghanistan than we ever did in Iraq, simply because they are trained and proficient, and we're fighting a war that we've never trained for. In all my military training, I never was trained in desert urban warfare, ever. And that's exactly what we're fighting. And we can go back to history. We had Russia try to fight those same fighters in the hills of Afghanistan. And you see what happened after they finally repelled one of the greatest superpowers in the world back to their own country. And I think that's what's going to happen to us. We're going to come back with our tails between our legs eventually. There's not an attainable mission over there. We're not trying to secure a village that was overtaken by an enemy that's doing something bad to the population. The population, unfortunately, of the people that we fight against are the relatives of the fighters that we fight against. So it's inconceivable that we should even be there. and we're losing lives. How many flags do we have to hand to parents and spouses and try to explain why they died? I think it is not a war that we can win, nor is it even worth winning at this point.
Well, Chuck, we're speaking during Thanksgiving week, and your family, your kids, must be very thankful to have you home.
I have a 17, a 16-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 17-month-old. And my oldest is a boy. He's going to graduate high school this year. And, you know, he's had his go-round with, you know, maybe I should go in the Army. Maybe I should do what my dad did. And I don't tell him not to. I don't discourage him. I just tell him I want him to have a freedom of choice. I want him to be able to do the things that he aspires to do. He wants to be a computer scientist. He wants to program and write programs for computer software. And I said, hey, if that's what you want to do, I want you to be able to do it. Absolutely, I think they're all thankful at times with Dad being home this Thanksgiving. Me and my wife just spoke yesterday morning, and we got to spend a weird, unheard of couple hours together without interruption. And she said, you know, we just got word that one of our friends had been killed over in Iraq, so now there's a spouse and a small child that's going to be going through the rest of their life without their father and their husband. And, you know, she said, I'm just glad that you're home. I'm glad you made it through. And I said, yeah, I'm very thankful. I am thankful that we do live in the country that we live in. I'm thankful that there are people out there defending our safety and in our freedoms. And I just hope that we can come together and realize that wars have to be fought, and then there's some that don't have to be. And we don't have to create wars just to say we can. And I just hope for my kids' sake that they can grow up in a peaceful world without war and death and all those bad things that we're witnessing right now, and the recession and the stresses of life, and that they can just be happy. And, you know, I'm actually in college now. Now that all my military service is over with, I'm actually going to college, using the money that I earned as a benefit of being in the military. And my favorite subject is government, because I like to read and listen to how we're supposed to be and see how far off we are right now. But, you know, our founding fathers just wanted a country that could be free of oppression because of religion or sex or background or financial status or any of those things. They just wanted us to be. And that's all that I can ask for now this Thanksgiving, is that maybe in the next 12 months to the next Thanksgiving, maybe we can get a little closer to that. And it all happens with each person changing. I was told by a senior leader in the military, said, you know what, you really don't matter to us because you're only one person and we're the Army. And I said, you are exactly right. I am only one person. And I said, and you are a big Army, and you are the government and the military. So let me tell you something. When a lot of one people get together and they have had enough of it, a million people, individual voices speaking at one time are far louder. And guess what happens? The tide will change, and we will overcome, not out of spite, but out of necessity of this is the right thing to do. And one last thing, when somebody asks me, why do I do what I do? I try to find some great answer. You know, I want it to sound really smart. I want it to sound good. I wanted it just to be a good sound bite, and I couldn't. After about 45 seconds, I said, you know, because it's the right thing to do. At the end of the day, when I go to sleep, I'm tired. I'm exhausted. But, you know, when I lay my head down, I know that I've done everything that I could that day. I don't worry about tomorrow or worry about what happened yesterday. It's that day to be the best man, best person that I could be, and hope that I have a breath the next morning to wake up and do it all over again. And that's just where we're at now, I guess.
DisposableWarriors.com is the website. Chuck Luther, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yes, ma'am. You too.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am.
For more information about advocacy work for soldiers, log on to our website, talknationradio.org, and in the coming weeks, we'll post links to as many such groups as we can find. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.